grandfather tell me how it was when you were...
Good afternoon and welcome to Living Permaculture on KDNK. I'm Vanessa Harmony of Colorado Edible Forest in Glenwood Springs, Colorado. On today's episode, you'll hear the second part of my interview from July 2025 with Robert Purvis, where we'll hear more about fruit tree grafting tips and tricks and about Robert's travels to Mongolia. You'll hear a modified introduction and outro. Enjoy! A few years ago, when I was hunting for sources of cold, hardy fruit tree propagation material called scion wood, I came across the website for Purvis Nursery and Orchard in Homedale, Idaho. Since then, Robert, or Bob, has been a source for me of scion wood, rootstock, and mentorship. Bob Purvis earned his Master's of Science in Horticulture from Washington State University. He spent his earlier career working in roles as an industry horticulturist and as a USDA agricultural statistician. During those times, he gained experience growing fruit in Minnesota, Washington State, and Alaska. In 2007, Bob moved to Idaho and opened Purvis Nursery and Orchard in 2008. The purpose of his nursery is to graft, grow, and sell trees of hard-to-find fruit cultivars, primarily apricot, but also apple, pear, plum, and cherry, that will survive and ripen in USDA zones 2 to 6. His orchard of approximately 1.5 acres is being used as a germplasm repository for fruit cultivars for the North Country and Western Mountain states. Since 1985, he has taught grafting and pruning classes for the general public. He offers orchard consulting for homeowners and top grafting for commercial growers, where he grafts new varieties onto established fruit trees. He sells fruit to the general public, concentrating on cultivars introduced by the University of Minnesota, the USDA Agricultural Research Service, and the New Jersey Apricot Breeding Program, rather than the more commonly available commercial cultivars. Bob, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Getting back to the nitty-gritty about grafting, what type of grafts do you normally use? What type of grafting cuts do you normally use for your nursery trees?
I normally, the primary way I do it is whip and tongue grafts in the spring, but I also do chip budding in late August or early September. And I found that there's some pretty strict limits on how late into September you can graft. That is, I think I've never had a successful chip bud after the 10th of September on any fruit, whether it's apple or pear or the string fruits.
Because then it gets too cold and the callus tissue
can't
form.
Enough time. Yeah, we don't have enough time for the chips to harden off fully.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the serious problems we have with our chip budding here is, and I've coped with this in various ways, I'll leave the plastic budding tape on for like 8 weeks or so.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I take it off, our winters here are so dry, well, they are just so dry in general, that what happens is that the bark on the outside of the chip begins to dry out and curl, and it'll pull away from the understock.
Right.
So the ways to deal with that, one was to try and spray it with an anti-desiccant,
mm-hmm.
like high-tech polymer or wilt-proof. Another way was to paint the chip with Doc Farwell tree paint, which I think is a better way to do things.
Well, I have tried a little bit of budding, but I'm not as experienced there. And for my grafts, I normally just do a splice graft, so I forego the tongue part.
That's certainly easier to do, or quicker.
Yeah, it's quicker. Saves you 2 cuts, but I can see why for cambial contact and also for security of things not moving around, why the tongue is useful.
Yes, it is.
And, go ahead.
Of course, but cutting the tongue is where about 99% of the injuries occur on a grafting class.
Right. Well, the part about grafting I have found to be the most humbling has been keeping my knife sharp. And so I've also honed my knife sharpening skills over the years. What is your preferred knife sharpening method or tool?
Well, I have a carborundum stone, which has both a coarse side and a fine side. And I'm using Tina grafting knives, which are made of very hard steel, and they're made in Germany. And when I'm sharpening a knife, I put some water or saliva on the sharpening stone, and then I start pushing the knife away from me with the bevel side down, and the knife makes about a 23-degree angle with the stone. And I push the knife across and outward against the stone, and then I put a few strokes on the other side so I don't have a razor edge. And Del Stubbs, who is a building contractor and knife manufacturer up in northern Minnesota, is the one who really honed my grafting skills.
Well, another topic I wanted to ask you with regard to grafting was just something, a detail I saw in one of your handouts you had created, and you instructed to avoid using the top 1 to 2 inches and the bottom 1 to 2 inches of a scion for grafting. Is that just because it may have dried out from those exposed tips during storage?
Well, the thing is, like, if you have, if one were cutting wood from an apple tree or an apricot or some other tree, the last inch or two, if it was stuff that grew like in July or August, the buds are going to be close together, and it's going to be harder to make your cuts. You know, cutting through buds with a grafting knife is much harder than just cutting through wood. And then, Vanessa, the reason why using the very bottom of a shoot, like a 1 foot stick, is that there are plant growth regulators in the tips of a shoot on a tree. I believe they're called auxins. And the auxins inhibit buds breaking below the shoot tip. This is how the tree controls its buds so that you don't have a mass of brush on the tree, but just a few shoots here and there. So those auxins can have some effects, making it a little harder for buds on a graft to break dormancy if it's made from the bottom part of a scion. But I try and cut my scions in such a way that neither problem is an issue. And the problem with the tips of the branches is mostly just with stone fruits, that is, with apples or pears, and even European plums, it's not an issue at all.
I see. And what is your opinion regarding using water suckers or water sprouts for grafting material for scion wood? Because I've heard differing schools of thought.
Yeah, I would say that it's certainly permissible to use water sprouts from a tree if they're the right diameter. They usually have a lot of water and nitrogen in them. And, of course, water is a key component in callus tissue. But I know, on the other hand, some researchers have said that, this is kind of getting into some more details here, but it might be worthwhile. Some researchers have said that if you graft with wood from a juvenile tree, one that has never borne fruit, that it may take longer to come into production than if you graft with wood from a bearing tree.
Interesting.
And that's something I think that has not been fully proven, but it is something to think about. And I know that, like, I was in a situation once grafting in Yakima where we had to use wood from nursery trees for our top grafting job, and that was definitely not considered a best practice, but we had to do it.
Right, and I've done that before, too.
Yeah, and another thing which you may have had to do if you got wood from a germplasm repository like Corvallis, is grafting with two-year-old wood that is wood from that's grew not last year but the year before that. But some of my pear trees here were grafted from wood from Corvallis that was had come from 2 years ago instead of one, and that was all they could provide.
Well, that's good to hear, because that's something I used to consider a no-no and avoided, but then I started to think, well, why not? And so I started trying it, and it worked.
Yes, I think the main thing that would cause people to caution you about not doing that as a rule would be the fact that there can be a layer in wood that's like two seasons old. It is a little bit narrower, and it probably has less water in it, and it's more mature, so it's less apt to form callus tissue by a little bit, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So those are just, and then, oh, the other thing, too, is it might have flower buds rather than leaf buds on it. That would be a major consideration.
Right.
If you have a flower bud, like on an apple or a pear, on your cyanwood, once you graft it, of course, it'll bloom.
Mm-hmm.
And then your hope is that the cyan will put out a shoot, but the shoot may be rather weak and short the first year because it would be the equivalent of a borse shoot on a bearing apple tree. You know, it's the shoot that produces the mixed buds of leaves and flowers the following year.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that you do the whip and tongue graft for most of your nursery trees. And is that the case for all of the fruits?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And I know, and I'm sure you know this yourself already, Vanessa, that when you make apricot grafts in our dry climate here, I use whip and tongue. I dip the grafts in wax to seal them. And then I put the grafts in sawdust or maybe potting soil in a pot with holes in the bottom. And I put a plastic bag over it to hold in the moisture. And after about maybe 10 to 14 days, and sometimes even as little as 4 days, the buds on the cyan will start to move. And that's usually a sign mm-hmm. that the graft was a success. And if they don't move within 3 weeks' time, you probably have a very poor union that might not support much growth, especially if the weather turns hot.
Right.
And with peaches, I have a hot callusing tube. It's a PVC tube 2 inches in diameter and about 4 feet long, and it has a number of slits or slots cut in the top.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two heating cables, like you would use for heating a gutter or a drain pipe,
okay.
that run the length of the pipe. And I have the thermostat for the heating cables set for 80 or 85 degrees permanently. So at those temperatures, peach grafts will callus. And I've had a fair degree of success, like try 11 out of 19 grafts taking onto, I think it was onto St. Julian A.
Wow. And so you pack the grafted material inside the PVC tube?
Yes, I put the unions, I lay them in the slots,
mm-hmm. oh,
and then I put the roots are, and the unions in the slot, and then the cyan buds and the roots are at air temperature, which typically would be probably maybe around 45 to 60 degrees. And of course, you have to cover the roots to protect them. It's kind of a messy process with the roots.
What is your method for keeping your wax melted?
Well, I have a wax that my grafting mentor, Dan Whitney in Washington, made with after some trial and error with his mother. And it consists of five parts paraffin with two parts beeswax and one part Mexican rosin.
Oh.
And the question, I guess, that somebody might immediately ask is, well, why use Mexican rosin as opposed to what you would use in phys ed class for climbing the ropes?
Hmm.
Mexican rosin melts at about 140 to 145 degrees like the paraffin or beeswax.
Oh.
But ordinary rosin melts, I think, at about 190 to 200 degrees. So it's very difficult to combine substances with diverse melting points and have a usable wax.
How do you heat it?
Oh, I have a hot plate, and I basically have a double boiler arrangement. I have a pan or kettle with water in it, and then a tin can with the grafting wax in it that's heated by the water. But given the fact that grafting wax is rather flammable, it would be unwise to heat it directly on a hot plate. Plus, it would you get wax on the heating element, maybe, mm-hmm. which is bad.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, thanks for sharing some of your grafting tricks.
And Vanessa, I believe that just using a 5-2 mixture of paraffin, which people use in canning, to beeswax, which you can get from toilet rings, that would be satisfactory. But for large commercial jobs, where, like Dan did, where there needs to be a high degree of success, I think the Mexican rosin is a big help, but it's very hard to find it.
Yeah, it's not something I had ever heard of.
I think rosin is made from tree sap of different kinds.
I wonder what kind of trees.
I don't know.
Okay, well, the other topic I wanted to be sure to touch on is to talk about your visit to Mongolia last year. Can you share with our listeners about that?
Yes, I can. Back in 2016, I had a query from a agricultural missionary in northern Mongolia named Robert Berg. He's a Canadian man. He wanted to try and see if he could grow different apple, plum, and even apricot cultivars that were cold hardy in northern Mongolia, where wintertime temperatures drop invariably to minus 40 Fahrenheit or Celsius every winter.
Wow.
So I sent him some cyanwood, and he used Malus baccata, Siberian crab apple, as a rootstock for the apples. And I forget what he used for plum, but he used Siberian apricot for the apricots. And he was able to, I think, get a crop of all of those in 2023. But he is about 7 miles from the border with Siberia. And it's the northern Mongolia has the best soils and the best water supply. The rivers in northern Mongolia flow northward to Lake Baikal, which empties ultimately through other rivers into the Arctic Ocean. But there had been no fruit industry in Mongolia, period, in terms of tree fruits. And Robert Berg was determined to see if something could be done. So I went over there to look at the trees that he had grafted from my cyanwood and just to generally discuss with him things that could be done or what he had successfully done. And it was quite educational. I've never seen such a bad combination of poor soil, wind, drought, and cold.
Wow.
For fruit trees to survive in. It makes growing in Alaska or Minnesota look like a snap by comparison. So I spent 5 days with him, and I saw that some of the plums that survived there successfully were ones like Titson number 5, which I have here, Titson number 3, and I think those are both Manchurian plums, and also Brook Gold, which is out of the Brooks, Alberta. I think there's a breeding program there that Agriculture Canada has. So it was kind of a thrill to see plum trees that were surviving and had blossomed successfully and borne fruit for off and on for several years.
Neato.
Yeah, and the primary thing that they're growing for berries in Mongolia is sea buckthorn, which you might be familiar with.
Yeah, I grow that in my nursery.
You do? Well, sea buckthorn is very well adapted to Mongolia's climate and soils, and they have a commercial industry there that makes juice from the sea buckthorn berries. So I had a chance to drink sea buckthorn juice, and it tastes very similar to orange juice.
Wow.
And like orange juice, it has a very high vitamin C content.
My sea buckthorns, since I started them from seed last year, are still pretty small, and so I'm eager to taste the fruit for myself, but I can only imagine.
Yeah, well, it's worth growing. But I know that in Mongolia, they've had some terrible problems with birds on sea buckthorn. And then the other thing, too, is the sea buckthorn bushes, after a certain point, they become a thicket because they put up suckers from the roots.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way they can really harvest them is to wait until frost and then put out like sheets or other things and then catch the berries after they fall off the bushes and then make them into juice.
Wow.
And Robert Berg had very his raspberry bushes or raspberry plants were growing very well. He also had gooseberries and black currant, and even had some cold hardy grapes growing against the south wall of his house.
Wow.
Like Valiant, for example, which I know had been tried in Alaska. And then there were some Russian grape cultivars that I don't think we have those here.
No, I haven't heard of any Russian grape cultivars.
Yeah, I know that just north of the border with Siberia, there's a Mongolian subgroup called the Buryats. And Rob said that the Buryat tribes were they're highly successful with gardening and maybe even growing berries. But for him or me to go into Russia would have required paying $200 for a visa.
Wow.
And I learned a lot about the history of Mongolia. And I found out that Genghis Khan was ruling an empire that covered most of Asia from about, I think, 1260 to 1330. And would you believe it was not a dictatorship or a monarchy? It was a democracy.
Wow.
And he allowed his subjects complete freedom of religion, whether they were Christian, Buddhist, or Muslim, as long as they obeyed the laws of the land. And he had councils from the tribes to advise him. And he had the world's first pony express because the empire was so vast. And even though he was ruling over a vast empire, he lived in a felt yurt, what the Mongolians would call a gir,
mm-hmm.
Even when he was ruling over this vast empire. So he lived a simple lifestyle. Quite a guy.
Very inspirational.
And the Mongolians kind of consider him the way we would consider like a mixture of Abraham Lincoln and the Lord Jesus Christ.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us. I'm glad you were able to travel there and hope you get a chance to go back after you've learned more of the language.
Yeah, well, I certainly intend to. The parts of Mongolia where that would be suitable for fruit production would be like extreme southwest or extreme southeast Mongolia near the Chinese border. But the problem is, even though they have a decent climate, I think it's part of the Gobi Desert, and there's no infrastructure there to support a fruit industry, and the population is very sparse.
Mm.
So there's some real handicaps there with trying to start industry in that part of the country.
Yes, and maybe just backyard applications, if that's a...
Well, that's right, Vanessa. That is, there's women gardeners in Darkhan, which is a city of 100,000 people that are growing plums successfully.
Well, you are a wealth of knowledge, and your years of experience are invaluable. So thank you for sharing them with us.
By all means.
In preparation for closing, I wonder if you have any words of reflection or inspiration or any topics that you wanted to bring up for our listeners before we wrap up?
Well, I would say that if anybody is contemplating trying to plant a large orchard and with hopes of making it commercial, my advice would be to do a soil test before you buy the land or before you plant any trees, and send the soil samples to a laboratory that is in your area and that can analyze everything. I was sending my soil samples from Idaho to a lab in Omaha, Nebraska, which was a very good lab,
mm-hmm.
but they were using the wrong test for phosphorus for a desert soil. So I had phosphorus deficiency manifesting itself in my trees, and yet there was plenty of phosphorus in the soil. It's crazy. So my soil consultant here in Idaho instead had me send the samples to a lab in Moses Lake, Washington. And that showed that as far as the trees were concerned, using their carbonic acid to try and get phosphorus out of the soil or phosphates, the trees said that the soil was deficient. So, and then I think the other thing is I've seen at least one friend start big and then have some spectacular failures. So I would say start small and then add to your orchard year by year. And I would also say that it might be a good thing to have like one or two cultivars that are commercial in your area, if there are such, and then you have a few that are experimental that look promising, and then the other ones can be ones that you're interested in, like heirloom apples or disease resistant or stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other thing would be to talk to a local farmer or extension agent and ask them, what are some of the primary insect and vertebrate pests you have here? And you might also, that person might also drive around the area and see what kind of fruit trees are actually growing in the neighborhoods, so that you don't, for example, try and plant a nectarine tree in North Dakota, for example.
Well, that's all very good advice. If any of our listeners are interested in connecting with Bob Purvis of Purvis Nursery and Orchard, they can visit his website and find his contact information at purvisnurseryandorchard.weebly.com. So Purvis Nursery and Orchard is one word, .weebly, W-E-E-B-L-Y.com.
That's right.
Bob sells fruit, scionwood, grafted fruit trees, and rootstock. He offers grafting and pruning classes for the public, orchard consulting, and custom fruit tree grafting services. He's available to take soil and leaf samples and send them to a laboratory and provide recommendations for ground fertilizer and foliar applications. Bob Purvis, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy nursery and orchard schedule to join us today, and thank you for all you contribute to the agricultural and horticultural community.
You're quite welcome, Vanessa. Have a great day and evening.
Thank you. And thank you also to our listeners for joining us today. I'm your host, Vanessa Harmony of Colorado Edible Forest in Glenwood Springs, Colorado. You can find my contact information at coloradoedibleforest.com. Tune in next month on KDNK on the third Monday of the month at 4 p.m. for another episode of Living Permaculture. I'll talk to you then.